Welcome to the 18th episode of the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Good morning, everybody, or good evening, or whatever time it is where you're listening. Today, we are in Brussels, or Bruxelles, or Brussel, a trilingual city if ever there was one. And we're about to speak with Professor Patrick Bontemps, who is a professor of pediatric gastroenterology at the, now wait for this, I've been practicing my French all week, at the Université Libre de Bruxelles, and he's also affiliated with the Hôpital Universitaire des Enfants Reine Fabiola. Now, for those of you for whom my French is an insurpassable barrier, that's the Free University of Brussels. And he's now in his office at the University Hospital for Children, Queen Fabiola. He is in his office, and that explains some of what we're going to hear in the background, which is the noise of children who are having, for one reason or another, to spend their time there. So with that, Patrick, welcome.
Thank you so much, Alex. And your French is fantastic, you know. Especially the way you say Reine Fabiola. Can you say it again once?
Let's see if I can do this. Non, tu rigoles. Reine Fabiola.
Yeah, so wonderful. The R you are pronouncing were very, very, very cute, as we already said before.
Okay, so before you get me blushing again, I want to point out that you're one of the most difficult people to interview that I can imagine. I've been through your CV. I've noted that there's nothing personal, nothing at all personal in your CV. It's all business. And even when I tried a Facebook search, I tried an internet search, and you're one of those rare people who has scrubbed any mention of himself from social media. So congratulations, although I'm a bit baffled as to how to begin. You were born in 1965. Let's start there. Where were you born?
I'm born in Brussels.
So in Brussels, and it looks as if you've really haven't fallen far from the tree, which is to say that your educational career, what of it I can trace, and your professional development has all been inside the Brussels Ring Road.
Exactly, yes. I have been going to a primary school 50 meters from the house. Secondary school was maybe 500 meters from home. Free University of Brussels is, of course, in Brussels and not very far from home, just a little, 10 kilometers, something like this, probably less. And then I indeed start my pediatric residency in this hospital where I'm working here since 87, finally, because the last 3 years I spent a lot of time in this hospital. I made a night shift as a nurse during my medical education also. So I'm really, indeed, as you said, I didn't fall far from the tree. And I can add that I am living in the house where I am born.
Wow. Most of us have to go away in order to come back. Otherwise, the people who have known us since we were children just say, "Huh, Patrick, how did you get to be so smart? I remember you when." But no, you've been one of those people whom everybody saw as worth keeping around, worth fostering, a talent who had to be held on to, which is just great. But I have a bone to pick with you in that, and that is that you became a hollow viscous gastroenterologist, an endoscopist. Now, why did you decline to go into the liver? We could have used a man like you.
Well, you know, my mentor was Sami Cadronel.
Aha.
So two people finally start pediatric endoscopy. One was in Brussels, Sami Cadronel, and he was my mentor, and I was working with him until he died in 2020. I've been very, very close to him, a very strong relationship. And, well, of course, then my major, finally, interest have been endoscopy for 4 years. The other one was Jean-François Mougenot, who is living in Paris. Mm-hmm. And it's also a friend. In fact, we have a patient in common that is a passion in common, that is mountain climbing. This is how we met. In fact, one day I was giving a lecture in Nancy in France, and then I just saw him reading a book about climbing in Himalaya, and then I started talking with Jean-François at that time.
And so not just alpinist, but Himalayaist? I don't know if that word exists in French, but if it doesn't, I've just made it up. So, but you elected to climb the mountain, if I may say so, of pediatric endoscopy. And of course, that brought you into contact with the need best to diagnose and best to treat Helicobacter pylori and the disorders that it causes. You've supplied me with a review article about H. pylori, and frankly, there is too much to know. You've cited so many studies, and those studies, they don't leave me with many conclusions as to how best to approach the problems of diagnosis in the symptomatic, diagnosis in the asymptomatic, as with screening programs, and then finally, treatment of those demonstrated to be infected and of those in their social circle. Espagan has recently issued an update on what to do and how to do it. And I think we would be doing those who are listening to this podcast a favor if we could, in some respects, move toward summarizing those recommendations in respect of the points that I've mentioned. That would be, first, diagnosis in the symptomatic. There are so many ways to approach this. You have urine assays, serum assays, breath assays, and then, working through the endoscope, tissue sampling with histopathologic or molecular diagnostic approaches. Which do you use, and how do you choose among them?
So first thing, we, as you mentioned, we are indeed now working on reviewing the guidelines that were published already. The previous one were published in 2017, but based on a review of the literature that ended beginning of 2015. So I will speak about my point of view and not yet about the point of view of the group doing these guidelines. And mostly Helicobacter pylori infection is not causing symptoms in children. So when a child comes and complains, and that these complaints may suggest upper GI involvement, esophagus, stomach, duodenum, or anything, the first thing to do is to perform an endoscopy. We usually recommend not to do it at the first time you saw the child. What I was doing when I had more time is to ask the child to come back. Unless he have alarm symptoms, then we just ask to come back a few days, 1 week later, just to see if the pain didn't change and is really localized. And then if indeed the symptoms are quite stable, then we suggest endoscopy. During endoscopy, we can diagnose eosinophilic esophagitis, erosive esophagitis, eventually achalasia, motor disorders, and eventually also lesions in the stomach, and especially look for ulcers, stomach and duodenum, and look for celiac disease eventually if it's a possibility. And in some cases, ulcers will be linked to Helicobacter pylori. We published a paper not so long ago about the evolution of the proportion of ulcers in children that are linked with Helicobacter pylori infection. And it's roughly about 40% and stable during the last 25 years. So we are not, and this is what is said in the guidelines, we are not looking for H. pylori infection, but we are looking for a lesion that may explain the symptom of the child. And eventually, it will be ulcers, and eventually it will be ulcers linked to Helicobacter pylori. Or it can be nodular gastritis with an infection by Helicobacter pylori. And then we will eventually suggest a treatment for that disease.
Is there room in your pre-screening approach, the two-visit approach, for using one of those fancy techniques referred to in your recent review, such as, I'm thinking now of a Mexican team that diagnosed H. pylori using PCR on an oral swab, or stool antigens. And my question is, if you can pre-screen for H. pylori, why not?
Well, in fact, if your pre-screen is positive, what you will still have to do is an endoscopy to look for ulcers, to look if there is not another lesion that explains the symptoms, mm-hmm. and to have access to antimicrobial susceptibility testing. So you need to isolate the bug also in order to have it. And if the test is negative, the symptoms are still there. Mm-hmm. So you will, again, perform an endoscopy. As I said earlier, 60% of ulcer disease, at least in Brussels, are not linked anymore to Helicobacter pylori. So the fact that the non-invasive test is positive or negative, you will still end up with doing endoscopy. So why not going directly and save a little bit of public money?
With regard to antibiotic susceptibility, I'm thinking by analogy now, which is always treacherous, to alpha-1 antitrypsin storage disorder. One no longer takes a sample of serum and subjects it to electrophoresis. Instead, one looks using PCR and peripheral blood DNA for the particular mutations that underlie, in by far most persons seen, the M, S, and Z phenotypes. Is there enough consensus in terms of antibiotic sensitivity or resistance among bacterial sequences to permit using PCR to assess susceptibility or resistance to particular antibiotics?
It can be used for two antibiotics, mainly for macrolides, because then there's not a lot of mutations described, and so it's quite easy on any material to know if the bacteria is resistant or susceptible to macrolides. And we know some mutations for quinolone, but we are not using quinolone in children. But this is something that is used in adults. And so for around 10 mutations, we can identify on a PCR. So this is something that can be suggested indeed using PCR instead of culture. And now, you know, with this COVID thing, everyone is able to do PCR everywhere in the world.
That's for sure. How long does it take you at your institution to obtain culture insensitivity results for H. pylori?
About 10 days.
Well, what do you do? Let's say that you've observed nodular gastritis or an ulcer. You're still not in a position, until a couple of tests come back, to ascribe those findings to an H. pylori infection, if I've understood you correctly. It could be something else that's giving you either of those appearances. If we pathologists are doing our job, then you might have your answer as to H. pylori detected, yes or no, within, say, 2 days, maybe even within one. I'm holding the flag high here. But if if that set of tests comes back negative, then what do you do until culture insensitivity results are in hand? Of course, I haven't mentioned urease production, which, as I understand, can be done there in the endoscopy suite. A smear, a change in color, and you have a preliminary answer. What do you do until the doctor comes? What do you prescribe and how do you treat until the culture insensitivities results are in your hands?
If there is an ulcer, we will start a proton pump inhibitor directly, and then suggest an eradication treatment if we can identify the infection by Helicobacter pylori. If it's nodular gastritis, then usually we don't treat until we have all the results. And we take time to see parents and children in consultation box to explain what we found, what it means, what are the risks eventually for the future, what will be the outcome in terms of symptoms with if we prescribe eradication treatment, and what are the risks also of the treatment. And we really think it's important to have the time to do that and not to do it on the day of the endoscopy, in order to really explain well and to obtain a good compliance of the family with the treatment. This is another article that I sent to you to prepare this this interview. And we know that compliance to treatment must be above 90%. That means that the correspondence between what has been prescribed and what the child is really taking at home must be higher than 90%. I usually make a joke with the family and say, oh, at school with 50%, you're okay. But with me, for that treatment, you must have more than 90%. That means you cannot make any mistake.
I would imagine that a family whose child is in distress, so apparent that one goes to visit the doctor instead of saying, oh, yeah, you'll be better tomorrow, that there's quite a bit of motivation to carry on and to treat. Are the antibiotics or their effects so unpleasant that people discontinue them as intolerable?
The side effects are described in about one-third of the patients. Usually it's mild, diarrhea, abdominal pain, cramp. While with some medication like bismuth, it's dark stools also that can be seen. Modification of the taste also can be described. And it's indeed something we take time to explain to the family. You may experience this, this, and this. And it will be important not to stop the treatment at that moment. And if really it becomes too difficult, just call us or come to see us and we will evaluate things with them.
You recommended a quadruple therapy. Four agents. Have I got that right?
No, so that's the third article I sent to you about
a quadruple
therapy with bismuth. Mm-hmm. But most of the time we are still prescribing a triple therapy tailored to antimicrobial susceptibility. Mm-hmm. So it's always high-dose PPI.
Okay.
Why high-dose? It's because antibiotics are not efficient in an acidic environment. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to have a very good suppression of acid secretion. We give amoxicillin unless there is an allergy to penicillin, of course. We give it in 3 times a day. And we are using a high dose, like it's used now frequently for respiratory disorder, meaning we give 75 to 80 milligram per kilo per day. And then the third agent will be macrolide, clarithromycin, or metronidazole, depending on the antimicrobial susceptibility. If we have resistance to both, then we favor metronidazole instead of clarithromycin.
I guess my question must be now, with this kind of parent consulting, with parents who ought to be strongly motivated, the persons from whom your team will have learned the most are the non-compliant. What are the reasons for not following through on the part of a family?
Well, the factor that we identify in the article is side effects. So there is a clear link between side effects of treatments and lower compliance. But lower compliance means that below 90%, the eradication rates reach only 50% or less. And above 90%, then you have you can reach 90% of eradication rates in your series. So what we learn also from this, indeed, from patients, is that it's useless to try to prescribe these kind of drugs to a child who is vomiting.
Right.
Or having difficulty to swallow pills.
Right.
Then it's sometimes better to wait and give some time so that the family may understand better and the child would be in a better situation to accept the treatment and follow it till the end. Otherwise, we favor the appearance of resistance and eradication later may become very, very, very difficult.
I want to ask now about what you prescribe, if anything, for the asymptomatic parents or siblings of a child who has demonstrated H. pylori infection.
We are not doing, in fact. We are only dealing with symptomatic people. But there are some series showing that eradication rates, and especially probably reinfection, could be lower if you treat all the family. Again, it's a question also of success you can achieve with your treatment. If you have 90% of success, then it can be eventually interesting to cure the family. But if you are using a treatment or your personal success is only 60 or 70% in intention to treat, then I think it's prescribing a lot of antibiotics and maybe will not be so efficient. But there are data now showing that indeed treating the family would be interesting, especially probably in some countries where the prevalence is very high, or in some families, mostly migrant families, in Belgium, where the infection rate is quite higher.
There we go into the area of different populations, of incidence rates, and of public health approaches that might be taken to H. pylori infection. For example, a newly arrived family from, let's say, Syria. They've come through the camps in Turkey. They've found a home now in Brussels, in Belgium. And the children are toddler age, coming into kindergarten, coming into school. Those kids, the way that kids share bodily fluids, those kids are little foci for introduction, potential introduction, of a number of pathogens into the generally healthy indigenous population of much of Brussels. So should we screen everybody who lives in, or rather, should we screen everybody who lives in Isel, or, I'm hoping that I pronounced that correctly, that neighborhood in Brussels right next to the train station? Which, as I remember, is a pretty run-down neighborhood. Should we treat everybody who comes in, or screen everybody who comes in from a non-European Union area? What approaches are you taking, or are governmental agencies taking, in regard of public health?
There is no policy of systematic screening. And it's difficult to make probably calculations to see whether it will be efficient to prevent gastric cancer and ulcers. So there is no policy for the moment. I think treatment's still difficult. Treatments is causing symptoms. And efficiency is not as high as we would like it could be. So prevention of transmission, prevention of acquisition is probably something we should focus more for the moment. There is something that happened 50 or 70 years ago in most of our countries that helps to decrease the transmission of Helicobacter from the parents to the child. It also happens in Japan. The transmission, the young children mostly do not colonize by Helicobacter. It's not true in other countries, although declining, but not everywhere. For example, in Vietnam, because I'm working there, the prevalence is still as high as 85 or more than 85% in school-aged children. And so we are still looking to better understand what was positive in the change of living conditions in this or so-called developed countries to prevent the transmission. And I would favor such approach over screening and treating. Yeah, there is immunization. Some trials are made with vaccine, although we are waiting vaccine for more than 20 years, so I don't know if it will be efficient and arriving soon or not. And also in the living condition, we should have a look on this for sure.
We have one more point that I'd like to touch on, and that is if evaluation is contingent on symptoms, then how do you assess successive treatment? The symptoms disappear very well, but has the bug disappeared? And The question now is, do you rely on a follow-up endoscopy, or are you happy with something as non-invasive as stool antigen testing?
The best tests to control eradication are non-invasive tests, because still we cannot biopsy all the stomach. So for the histopathologist like you, cannot be sure there will not be Helicobacter somewhere. So breast testing and stool antigens with monoclonal antibodies are the best approach for controlling eradication.
Thank you. We are coming in toward the end of the time allotted to us for this interview, and I thank you for focusing for me the, well, for compressing, condensing, and explaining in a manner that I could understand that fire hose stream of work and of data that you present in that review article. I find it very difficult to drink from a fire hose, but this was a manageable amount of information and very manageably presented, and I thank you. We now come to the question of what song a Bruxellois will choose to present to us who didn't have the luck to be born there, something to summarize and to introduce in some ways what it's like to grow up within shouting distance of the Manacampis and the Grand Place. What's your song?
I was searching and thinking a lot. I was first trying to think about a Belgian singer.
And, okay, who else but Brel?
Who else than Brel, exactly, absolutely. And there is a beautiful song that is called Quand on a que l'amour, when we only have love. And this is really meaningful now because we are in Europe facing a war, and that would be very, very meaningful for sure. But I finally decided to ask for another song that is more related to the relationship between a father and his child. And this is a French singer, it's Renaud, and the song is Mistral Gagnant. It describes a relationship of a father, a bit childish, like me, in fact, that loves to play with these children, and we don't know if it's a daughter or a son, but it doesn't matter. And so they are laughing together, eating sweet things, and enjoying life together. So this is more meaningful for me, and maybe also for all the auditors. I don't know if they are like me, but what I really like in consultation is playing with the child there. We start laughing and saying nonsense things, and it's always a very good moment. These are the best moments in our work, I think. So, Renaud, Mistral Gagnant.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you very much. Folks, I've had another good session with an interesting person, and I hope that it's been of interest to you. If you think that we can make these interviews better, then please send your comments to office@espigan.org. Dr. Bontemps, mille merci. Thank you so much.
Avec plaisir, Alex.